Just a few words about Clint. He's an attorney and a longtime advocate for conservative and libertarian causes through the legal process. You've probably seen articles and reports of litigation that he's been involved with. He was native of New Jersey. He received his law degree from Cal Davis. Currently director of the Goldwater Institute's Sharp Norton Center for Constitutional Litigation. He's also a research fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution, and he was co-founder of the Institute for Justice, which does incredibly interesting work in business rights among the little people, the small business owners who are often beat up by administrative procedures in the government. He's a legal pioneer in a number of areas, notably in school choice matters. He's knows more than almost anyone in the state of legal actions to support school choice. And he was an assistant at the EEOC in Washington when Clarence Thomas was the head of that agency. And I guess got to work with Judge Thomas quite a bit back then. Clint, thank you very much for coming to Las Vegas. We're sorry that it's our first cloudy day in 2 or 3 months. Welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's really a pleasure to be here, and I have to say that this is the coolest Federalist Society lawyers chapter in the entire country. I have spoken in an awful lot of Federalist Society chapters, both students and lawyer chapters around the country, and many of them have really amazing attributes, but none of them, except you, have lunch at Fugo de Chao. In fact, I was hoping that Matt's introduction would go on for about a half hour or so, so I could continue chowing, but it's better for me if I don't. I am so excited to have written this book on immigration, and it's called Immigration Wars. Unfortunately, we weren't able to get copies to sell, but I brought a card which is at the registration desk that talks a little bit about the book. I understand that it's available at Amazon on both Kindle and regular. It's even going to have a Spanish language version. I understand that it's at Walmart and Costco. I've never had a book at Walmart and Costco before, so I'm pretty psyched about that. But writing a book with Jeb Bush was just a tremendous honor. I have known Jeb for about 15 years now. We first got together when we were working on his school choice program in Florida. And Jeb is a member of a very, very small and distinguished group. And that is politicians who I've never had to sue. he is a truly remarkable guy, and he will actually this weekend be appearing on all 4 Sunday talk shows. So by all means, tune into your favorite one and see Jeb. I personally hope that he runs for president, but for now, I'm excited to be talking about immigration with him. And if you need any further evidence about what a great guy Jeb Bush is, after the book was published, it took less than 24 hours for Harry Reid to be viciously attacking Jeb Bush. So I know the people in this room appreciate what a high honor it is to be castigated by Harry Reid. Not unusual, but nonetheless a high honor. In talking about immigration, and I really apologize for this mic, so can you guys hear me without the microphone? Or are we good? I'm going to use my courtroom voice. So we enter a debate that has been going on for 225 years in this country. And what is remarkable about the debate is that it hasn't changed at all in those 225 years. About 225 years ago, Benjamin Franklin described the scourge of German immigration in Pennsylvania. and he said that they were more likely to Germanize us than we were to Americanize them. And he noted that they were no more apt to take on our language and our customs as Americans would be to take on their complexion. So it's really kind of interesting, as a guy who's half German and half English, I'm wondering which complexion I have. But there are, of course, a lot of modern heirs to Benjamin Franklin's views, and one of them was my mom. My mom and I, who I ferociously loved, we agreed on almost every political issue. We voted alike, and the only issue that I can remember that we disagreed on was immigration. And my mom, her view was that when immigrants came to this country, they brought with them crime, they brought with them dependency, welfare dependency, and they stubbornly refused to shed their language and their customs. All of the immigrants, that is, except for the immigrants that she personally knew, all of whom were fine people who she would be happy to welcome into the American family. And I think that her views remain fairly dominant among a lot of Americans today. But in 2013, we desperately need to get our immigration policy right, because there are two conditions that we are experiencing right now which are unprecedented in our country's history and absolutely require us to get immigration policy right. The first is demographic. For the first time in our nation's history, we are no longer reproducing our population. We are producing births at a level lower than what is necessary to sustain our population. This has very important and very deleterious ramifications, because we no longer have enough people to sustain our welfare state. With the lowering birth rate, the projections of Social Security and Medicare running out of money are being advanced constantly. And there really is only one place that we can look to bring productive young workers into our economy, and that is to immigration. The good news about that is that our demographic challenge is much less than the demographic challenge in places like Europe and Asia. Asia, several countries, including China, are now producing half of what they need to sustain their populations. In Europe, it's about two-thirds. So this is potentially a competitive advantage. But for our own internal purposes, we desperately need to refuel our workforce. And the second factor is somewhat related to the first. For the first time in American history, America is being forced to compete for immigrants. We are no longer the main haven for the best and the brightest. And frankly, this has been a signature reason for America's soaring success over the last centuries, is that we have been a magnet for the best and the brightest. But when the best and the brightest attempt to come into our country, in many instances, they are greeted by an immigration system that is hostile to them. It often takes 10 years or more. If you were from India, which has the same quota as every other country, you can sometimes have to wait for decades to become an American citizen, even if you are an amazingly skilled engineer. And other countries are figuring this out and saying, we can take these immigrants. In fact, there is now a part of Chile which is called Chilcon Valley. And they're bringing enterprising, smart engineers from all over the world and saying, yeah, it takes about 6 weeks to get into the country. Try to compete with that here in the United States. And with our current immigration system, we can't do that. Now, in most conservative forums, the debate always starts with the question of securing the border. And here in Nevada, I can use a line that I often use in Arizona, which is this. I am concerned about the hordes of people crossing the border, bringing horrible values with them, and voting Democratic. And for that reason, I am in favor of erecting an impregnable wall that will prevent any further Californians from coming into the country. So when we talk about border security, let's be clear about which border we're talking about, okay? But seriously, this is obviously an issue that is very important both here and in Arizona. And securing the border consumes most conservative advocates on immigration. The Gang of Eight, for example, a major part of their proposal is to secure the border first, and then other immigration changes come into play. The House Republican delegation from Arizona actually put out a statement saying, we will not consider any immigration reform until the border is secured to our satisfaction. I think that is a very misguided position to take. It is a little bit like a physician saying to a cancer patient, I refuse to treat the cancer until the symptoms disappear. And that obviously is not the way to go about it. We need to start the conversation about illegal immigration by asking the question, why is it that people come illegally? Do they really want to risk their lives in the Arizona desert? Do they really want to turn over their future to drug cartels, which are now branching off into human smuggling? Do they really want to live in the shadows of American society, not being able to work openly and to become members of the community? To ask the question is to answer it. So why is it that so many people come illegally? And the answer is also the answer to the question, why do we need comprehensive immigration reform rather than a border security only or a border security first form of immigration? And that is, there is no way for these people to come legally. You often hear these people should get to the back of the line. There is a very sobering reality about our immigration policy today. There is no line. There is a backlog, but there is no line. If you want to come to the United States and become a citizen, you must come one of three ways. One is you have to squeeze into a very small number of work-based visas, or you have to have a family member in the United States, or you have to apply for something called the diversity lottery. It's not a line. It literally is a lottery. And every year, about 13 to 14 million people apply for that lottery, and you have a 1 in 250 chance of winning that lottery. When people think about immigration, one of the first images that comes to their mind is Ellis Island. There is no Ellis Island anymore. And so long as we don't allow legal outlets for immigration, we are going to have people coming illegally. So the best way to prevent illegal immigration is by creating a legal system of immigration that offers hope to people and some degree of certainty. And if you do that, I think you will achieve the goal without too much more of the wall building and drone flying and all of that sort of thing. Now, in a perverse sense, Barack Obama has done more to curb illegal immigration than any president in history. He's done that through three ways. One is he has deployed far greater resources to border security, increasing the border patrol and all of that. Second, and this is something that I think is a great secret in the Hispanic community, he has deported more illegal immigrants than any other president by a huge factor. But the third reason that Barack Obama has been so effective at illegal immigration is his efforts to kill the economy. If you look at the ebb and flow of immigration to the United States over the last couple of centuries, you will see that it ebbs and flows in perfect harmony with the economy. If there are no jobs, people don't come. And right now, there are very few jobs. And as a result, right now, the net migration from Mexico is zero. As many Mexicans are going back as are coming. And one of the reasons for that is the Mexican unemployment rate right now is 5.5%. Their economy is growing. In fact, I actually bought a Mexican ETF while I was researching this book because I didn't realize that their economy is growing so well. And their educational system is beginning to improve. And the irony is that 10 years from now, when we talk about an immigration problem with regard to Mexicans coming into this country, we may be talking about not getting enough rather than too many. So it really is imperative for us to fix our immigration problem across the board. We desperately need a flow of talent and workers into our country. And there is one statistic above, and if you get the book, you will see lots of statistics, but there is one statistic that says it all about how bad our immigration system is. I'm going to ask each of you to take a guess. Some of you may know. But I'd like each of you to think about the following question and make a guess silently to yourself. What percentage of legal immigrants coming into this country do you think are coming with work-based visas? What percentage do you think that is? Well, how many of you would have guessed the actual answer, which is 13%? Very few, if any. That is unbelievable. Traditionally, we have had a work-based immigration system. There is no other country on earth that has a figure that low. Canada has 1/10 of our population and issues more work-based visas than the United States does every year. This is ridiculous. So you ask the question, who's getting all of these visas? Since the 1960s, our immigration system has transformed from work-based to family-based. And when they define family, it's not how other countries define family, which is spouses and minor children. It is spouses, minor children, parents, and siblings. And guess what? When they come in, then they get those preferences too. It's what is called chain migration. And this is what we have to fundamentally fix about our immigration system. Because there's only so many immigrants that the country can absorb, and when 2/3 of those immigrants are coming for because of family preferences, it crowds out work-based immigration. So this is how Jeb Bush and I essentially propose to fix the problem. The first is to more narrowly define family preferences to include spouses and minor children. The second is to dramatically increase the number of high-skilled immigrants who can come. And one of the problems that we have right now is the one thing that continues to draw the best and the brightest are our universities. But when the smartest kids around the world come to our universities, they graduate, many of them with STEM degrees, which we can't produce enough of. From our own population, because our K-12 schools stink so badly. But they graduate, and then there's no visas for them to work here. So we educate thousands of Chinese students every year who return home to China. Is this a rational system? I think that it is. It's highly irrational. So we do support the idea of stapling a green card to the diploma of high-skilled students who graduate from our colleges and universities. We also think, in opposition to the unions, that we need to dramatically increase the number of low-skilled workers who are available in our country and give them a path to citizenship. Right now, when a guest worker comes, and we only allow about 50 or 60,000 each year to come into our country legally, we require them to declare that they will not seek American citizenship. That doesn't make any sense. These are people who come, they work, we get to see them. We use the term test drive in the book. And if they're not given a path to citizenship, they'll probably overstay their visa. In fact, over half of our illegal immigrants came in legally and overstayed their visas. And a lot of them were people who came into work and didn't want to leave. And then the fourth component of our immigration reform that we think is absolutely necessary is to restore Ellis Island, to open up a path for people who simply want to come to the United States and become American citizens. This would be the path that more distant relatives, like siblings and grandparents and parents and that sort of thing, they could come through the system, but so could the enterprising young person from Africa and elsewhere that have no way of legally getting into the United States at all. Well, what about the people who are here illegally? Well, if any of you have heard any of the media reaction to our book this week, you know that this has been the controversial issue, because Jeb and I have argued that the people who are here illegally, once they pay a fine or perform community service, would have a path to permanent residency and not to citizenship. When we wrote this book, we thought that was a really liberal idea. So much has changed politically over the last year that it is now seen as a Neanderthal conservative position. But here is our reason for not advocating path to citizenship. I mentioned to you earlier that 13 to 14 million people apply for the diversity lottery every year. These are people who would dearly love to come to the United States. Is it fair to them for people who came here illegally to not only be allowed to stay, but to become American citizens? We don't think so. And in fact, this is a critical component of our argument. For Americans to support whatever immigration policy we have, it must be enforced. It must be bounded by the rule of law. And what we learned with the 1986 amnesty is, if you hold people without consequence for coming illegally, you will get more illegal immigrants. And as a result, we think it is imperative that people not be rewarded with citizenship. We take the opposite view when it comes to people who were brought here illegally as children, what is called the DREAM Act. We do not think that the way President Obama went about it was right at all. In fact, we think that it was disdainful of the rule of law, because the president does not have unilateral authority to impose an immigration policy. But you know, when has that stopped Barack Obama before? But we think that young people who came here illegally, who know no other country, and who graduate from high school or join the military, should be allowed a path to citizenship. So that is, in a nutshell, our immigration proposal. We think that this law, which is now over 60 years old, just think, an immigration policy that was designed for the realities of the 1950s, it doesn't need to be patched anymore. We don't need to add yet another arrow or a box to an already overly complicated system. We need to start from scratch. We need to ask ourselves, what kind of immigration system makes sense in the year 2013? And that's what we tried to do in this book. My own newspaper, or the newspaper in my own state, I don't want you to think I have anything to do with it, the Arizona Republic, criticized us for upsetting the apple cart, the Gang of Eight plan and so forth. And the point is that we can't afford to make a mistake again. The opportunity for comprehensive immigration reform does not come very often. Right now, after the Republicans got shellacked in the last election, in large measure because of changing demographics, we have an opportunity to get this right, and I think we absolutely need to do it. I want to finish by saying this, and then I'm eager for your questions and your comments. For more than two centuries, Americans have agonized over our immigration problem. But having an immigration problem is not a reason for agonizing. It is a reason for celebrating. Because having an immigration problem means that people all around the world want to come here. They want to come here to work. They want to come here to raise their families. They want to come here to pursue the American dream. And all of that is a wonderful thing. Immigrants not only fuel our economy, they replenish the American spirit. Indeed, we should tremble at the prospect that one day we will cease to have an immigration problem because people no longer want to come here. And if that day happens, Lady Liberty will cease to be a beacon of welcome. She will be a mere historical relic. To prevent that tragic day from ever arriving, we need to fix our immigration policy, and we need to fix it today. Thank you so much for giving me that. Thank you. And you guys are probably so well fed and so sated that you're going to be very mellow in your classes. Now, seriously, have at it.
Anyone have any questions?
Yeah.
It was about a week ago, I read, and I don't remember the details, about Jeb Bush having switched his position on immigration. Could you clarify that a little bit?
You know, there was a single quote from an interview with Charlie Rose, I don't even know when it was, where it said that Jeb said, whatever path we take, whether it's a path to citizenship, which I support, or legal residency, or some, I can't remember what the third thing was, we really need to get on with this. Frankly, I don't think he remembered ever saying that. And all I can say is that when we wrote the book, we agonized over each and every policy that we came down on. Unfortunately, the story about the book in the first several days of the media was a flip-flop rather than an engagement about the ideas that were presented. I think that switching, although on Sunday he may get, you know, I suspect they will all ask him that question again. But now some of the columnists today, Michael Gerson, for example, came out with a commentary, and others are beginning to actually read the book and engage on the proposals in the book. So I'm hoping that first wave, it originated with our dear friend Matt Lauer, and I think they were much more interested in getting Jeb Bush than in seeing what we had to say. And I'm hoping that over time, the real message of the book will come out.
I have a question. I kind of a two-part question. On the issue of pathway to citizenship, have you guys thought that not being able to become a citizen sort of goes against the entire 250-year American story. That would be my first question. And then the second question would be that, as you know, permanent resident status is a precarious status right now because of the punitive laws that have been passed since IRA-IRA in 1996. And so I think people would be more comfortable with it if it wasn't so easy to become, to be removed as a permanent resident.
You know, I think your second point is really, really well taken. And I think that in the design of that, it would be imperative to make clear that these people could not, would have no greater chance of being deported than a citizen. On the first, you know, I have to tell you, this is something over which I've really, to use the word I used before, really agonized, and Jeb did as well. And the fact is that I think that people who did come here illegally recognized that it was a choice they were making that was likely to have consequences. And the situation in which many of these people currently live is horrible. You know, they can't call the police in my state, and because they'll be shipped back. You know, even if they're robbed or something horrible like that. So this step does allow people to come out of the shadows while at the same time saying, listen. And it says not just to these individuals, it says to future individuals who might be so motivated. There is only one way to become an American citizen, and that is to come through legal channels. For those who wish to become citizens, and they really, really care about that, we would not penalize them for going back to their countries and applying through what would now be a much more liberalized avenue for coming to the country and beginning the process over again. But we just think that this is the appropriate balance between fairness and the rule of law. And we made the wrong choice, I think, in 1986. We've seen the consequences of that, and we need to do better this time. Having said all that, one thing that I'm very excited about, a year ago, we were talking about legalized status versus mass deportations. I am happy that now we are arguing between legalized permanent residency and a path to citizenship. I think that is, those two positions are much closer, obviously, than the previous positions were. And frankly, it's something that I would not want to see be an obstacle to fixing these problems. I do think that the path or the argument that Jeb and I are making may be a way to bring House Republicans to the table who might otherwise torpedo comprehensive immigration reform, and that would be very incredible. Yes?
It's probably one of the few staunch Democrats in here. I happen to think your ideas are fairly progressive. I agree with a lot of what you're saying. I wish this wasn't so politicized. I wish all people, you know, Democrats, but don't see this as an American issue.
Yes.
That was a Democrat-Republican issue, because it seems to make sense. And to that end, with the student visas, because most everybody here has gone to college and seen their fair share of people come from other countries. So explain to me, for somebody who doesn't know immigration, what happens after they do their 4 years or they do their master's in engineering or get their doctorate? What happens to their status?
Right now, if they don't qualify for a skills-based visa, they have to leave.
Does that mean like if a company doesn't hire them out of school type of thing?
That's right. And it has to be a certain type of job. You can't just get a job in like a publishing company. And I actually, we devote one chapter of the book to individual stories. And one of them, who happens to be a dear friend of mine, went through this. And
It's a really perverse story, and I won't recall it in detail right at the moment, but she ended up getting married. And a lot of students, that's what they end up doing, because it is so hard for people. And this makes no sense, because we've had 4, or in some instances, 8 years to look at these kids, right? And we know that they're good. We know that they're smart. We know that they bring skills that we are incapable of producing because of our K-12 system being so bad. And by the way, we do. Being that Jeb and I are like total education policy nerds, of course we have a chapter on education in the book as well. But it just doesn't make sense to put them to this. And so I really appreciate your comments. One of the things I admire about Jeb, and I'll try to stop gushing, because I truly do not do that with very many politicians, but he really is someone who genuinely reaches across party lines on education, and I think will on immigration as well. But part of the reason for writing this book was to kick Republicans in the butt, because they've been largely impediments to doing this. Yes, ma'am.
Is there any provision in your plan to address border security?
Yes.
Or is it your position that our southern border is as secure as it?
Yes, we do think, and I hope no one will take my views as not supporting border security. We think that the nature of the problem has evolved. We think that if you adopt, in terms of the issue of illegal immigration, people crossing over illegally, that the best way to deal with that is to fix our immigration system. If you don't do that, no walls will be high enough to keep people from coming. But we have a horrific problem with drug cartels and serious risks of terrorism. And this is a very different problem, and one that I think we could not possibly react strongly enough to. Because it's interesting, my wife ran for the state legislature in Arizona, and when you run for anything in Arizona, you have to do 2 things. You have to file your papers, and you have to do a tour of the border. And so we went down there and talked to a number of ranchers, and they were totally at peace with illegal crossings for 20 years. They hired them, they married them, they accepted them into their community, and over the last 5 or 6 years, things have totally changed. People are being killed. The Border Patrol agents themselves often don't go near the border because they're outgunned. And so we think that in terms of dealing with this new problem, that it really has almost gotten to become a military level issue. Because we are dealing with, and we describe the cartels in our book, one of them is run by a billionaire. One of them is run by a former special operations office, military officer. These are quasi-military operations that are now being conducted, and they pour across our border. So, but in Arizona in particular, people see it as exactly the same thing. They see the illegal immigrants crossing the border as the very same thing as drug cartels, and we think that they're distinct problems and require distinct solutions. I saw another hand. Is it you, Robert?
Yes. I'm just curious about the genesis of the book. How did you guys decide?
You know, I love answering that question. I have felt like a fish out of water in Arizona since I moved there in this respect, in that it is still the land of Barry Goldwater. It is a live and let live state. The policy, the public policy opportunities are boundless. And yet I have been so uncomfortable with the prevailing view on immigration And in fact, I left the Republican Party a decade ago in large part because I was so out of step with our state Republican Party on this issue. And so I've always wanted to write about it or do something about it. And about a little over a year ago, Jeb Bush came to Arizona to talk on a completely unrelated topic. And when you talk on any topic in Arizona, the first question is always about interfacing, no matter what you're talking about. And someone asked Jeb, said, what do we do to stop the hordes of people coming across our southern border? And Jeb thought to himself for a moment and he said, let me reformulate your question a little bit. How can the Republican Party avoid committing suicide by continuing to alienate people with whom it shares values? Every jaw in the room dropped. It was like, you cannot say this at a conservative gathering in Arizona. And I thought to myself, I want to do something with this guy on this issue. And so I actually pitched the book to him. Lots of people are theorizing, oh, this must have been Jeb's, you know, first step in a presidential campaign. No, it was my idea. I pitched it to him. He said, you know what, I'd love to do that. And happily, a year later, we have a book together. Any last questions? Well, I want to thank you for being here. I want to thank you, most of you, for being fellow conservatives and libertarians. And Nevada and Arizona face similar challenges, but we also have similar opportunities. I'm honored to be in the battle with you, and I would just tell you not only to have a good weekend, but to go get it. Thank you very much.